Good evening, everybody. The class was officially entitled Jewish History, the years 3413 through 3829, the Hanukkah period. First of all, I'd like to thank, like I did last time, Rabbi Cantor, Rabbi Beryl Wine, the books of the prophets, the Navi, the Gemara Sanhedrin, and several other Gemaras for making their information available to me to draw from to be able to put together the class. I really should have entitled this class 3393, the period of Hanukkah, part one. Because it's highly unlikely that we will get to Hanukkah tonight. Because in order to understand what's going on during the period of time at Hanukkah, you really need a little bit of a history. So we're going to back it up and we're going to go back to the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, the beginning of the second temple. Just prior to the story of Purim, we all know the story of Purim, just prior to the story of Purim, the second temple, which was being worked on, was halted. Everything came to a stop. Cyrus, who was then the king, had no choice but to listen to his court, the people in his court that were anti-Jewish, and all attempts to continue building the second temple came to a permanent end. Cyrus dies soon thereafter, and when we go, you know, we left out a whole period of time. The last class we did ended with Noah, and we're picking up now with Cyrus. Things did happen in the world between Noah and Cyrus. And some people asked me, did you forget about that? I just wanted to talk about Hanukkah during the Hanukkah period. So no, I did not accidentally forget 2,000 years. We will go there and some of this will be filled in earlier before we, you know, before we get there as well. But right after he dies, ensuing chaos goes on. Succession, who's going to take over? And the throne of Persia ends up through a coup in the hands of Ahasuerus. And that's when the story of Purim occurred. We're not going to go through the Purim story tonight. We're not going to talk about that. But the whole desire, as we know, was to annihilate the Jewish people. And only the miraculously arranged, divinely inspired circumstances and events allowed the Jews to come through that period unscathed and unharmed. Mordechai and Esther got involved. And that ultimately averted the total disaster. However, this event of Purim, even though we like to look at it as such a wonderful miracle and everything happened, it left a tremendous scar on the Jewish people in general. And the psyche of the Jewish people, having just lived through this whole period and experienced the threat of being killed and dying, it left a terrible scar upon them. And the fact that they were going to build the Beis HaMikdash and that had to be stopped, you can imagine what that did to the people. They were starting, that they were forced to end and no longer able to do that. Being terrorized by all the people in the neighborhood. Everybody just wanted to kill the Jews. Letters coming out from the king, permission. Yeah, we survived, but they were so emotionally and psychologically hurt and wounded that slowly but surely despair began to sink into the people itself. Increasing numbers of Jews, both in the land of Israel as well as in Babel and Babylonia and Persia, began to assimilate and began to intermarry. You know, if you think about it a little bit, you know, I don't want to make a comparison of one to the other, but we have the after the Holocaust period of time, we have something very similar. We had no Beis HaMikdash that we were working on, but after the pains that everybody had gone through in Europe, so many people came out and they were able to maintain their religion. And like I say many times, those who came out who were not able to, you can't, God forbid, blame them. They experienced and went through something that we don't understand. And if those who had to leave or went off a different way, I told you once, it was a rabbi who said that when you have the halacha by a mizbeach, by the altar in the Beis HaMikdash, the halacha, the law was that when you brought a sacrifice, it was kodesh kodashim, was holy. And therefore, if it came off, you had to treat it in a special way. You had to treat the animal with certain rules and laws. A spark that came off the mizbeach, the halacha was, had to be treated the same way that the sacrifice had to be treated. It was holy. It was something very high. And the rabbis tell us, even in this generation, that when you meet somebody who's got a number on his hand, or somebody who survived the war, he has the same halacha as a spark that fell off the mizbeach. And he is to be looked at and considered the holiest of the holy. And you get a bracha from such a person. He kept religion. He didn't keep religion. It's irrelevant. It's not the point. He is the holiest of the holiest that you can possibly encounter and come in contact with. And you can understand it, because we've been through this before in history. This is not new. It's not new that we come through a tragic event, and it's normal that you start seeing assimilation afterwards. It's normal that you start seeing intermarriage afterwards. How society treats it, how we deal with it, we'll see what they did, we'll see what we do, but The bottom line is, it was understandable and it happened, even though the Torah says, Kimu v'kibu ha-Yehudim, they accepted the Torah, and they all knew. That was not the masses. The masses, unfortunately, left and intermarried and went away. And ironically, in contrast to the negative attitude that the Jews had, was the positive attitude towards the Jews by the Goyim, which meant that tremendous amounts of Goyim started converting to Judaism. So the beginning of the 4th century, before the Common Era, and going into the next millennium, all of a sudden we see a significant amount of people, the numbers of Jews are starting to come back up, but from non-Jews who are coming into the community, who are converting to Judaism because they want to be a part of the Jewish nation, they want to be close. So while we're assimilating and going outwards, they're in turn coming inwards and becoming more, trying to become more and more Jewish. This brought a lot of talent into the Jewish community that we were losing. It brought a lot of devotion to Jewish society that we were losing by these people coming in. We will later see that these converts and the descendants played very, very vital leadership roles in the Jewish community itself, and the advancement of Torah study was largely responsible to a lot of these people who are coming in at this period of time after Haman and Achashverosh. However, just as much as the people needed numbers, they also very, very much needed a leader. And they had people, they're getting people, but they didn't have a leader at this time. The leaders were pretty much taken away from them. And that's where such a person all of a sudden came into Israel, and that person's name was Ezra. And Ezra rose as a leader amongst the Jewish people. There's very, very little known about Ezra's private life. Some people say, in the Gemara books, that Ezra might actually be Malachi, one of the prophets. Malachi could be Ezra, but there's even less known about Malachi. So that doesn't help us any. But his public life and what he did for the Jewish people, that we're going to see, is very, very well known, and it's pretty amazing what Ezra did. He was a descendant of Aaron, and that made him a Kohen. He was a scribe. He was a scholar. The Jewish tradition gives him the honor almost at the same level of Moshe and Aaron. He was really put up there as one of the highest people that we've had in our history representing Klal Yisrael, representing Judaism. He was one of those unique individuals who was capable of combining the ability to be both the religious and the temporal leader of Israel at the same time. So he was a religious leader, but he also dealt with the people on the day-to-day, on the practical, what had to be done. He was what we call an action. I'm sure everybody here knows what an action is. Everybody's met and come in contact with an action. He was an action because he had an unbending will. And he had a clear view of the realities and necessities of the time, of the Jewish people, of the situation, what had to be done, and he would not let anybody push him off his path. He has a direction, he had something he wanted to achieve and accomplish, and he just went after it. And it was that force and that akshonis, that strength, that allowed him to accomplish as much as he did. Ezra was also, at the time, the greatest Torah scholar, and a conduit to later generations of all traditions of Torah and of Israel. He foresaw that the survival of Israel, whether it was in the old or new homeland in exile, was very, very heavily dependent upon the Jews' understanding of their loyalty to the oral law of the Torah. And Ezra recognized that without the oral law, Jewish tradition, the way it was known, could never survive and could not possibly go forward. With the end of the period of the prophecy in Jewish life, which was at this time, this was the last of the prophets at this period of time, the masses of Israel were no longer able to rely on the prophets for moral guidance, for transitional guidance. That's what they used to do all the time. They needed to know something, they went to a prophet. Who better to give you an answer than a prophet? He gets the answer straight from God, go to the prophet. But as the prophets are becoming far and few between, and that whole generation of prophecy is dissipating and disappearing, now they needed to get guidance from somewhere else. Ezra proclaimed that that only by making the masses of Israel understand the imperative of the oral law of the Torah, that the oral law supremacy in governing Jewish practices and values, only then will the Jewish people retain their spiritual creativity and be able to contend effectively with the foreign cultures which they were surrounded by. Because there's so much influence coming at them from all over, they need something solid to hold on to. They need something that they can make their own, that they can hold on to, that nobody should be able to pull them away from their path. If they don't have a leader, if they don't have something concrete to base themselves and to root themselves in, then they're going to totally dissipate and become no more. As you recognize that. In the year 353 before the Common Era, and there's a little bit of a debate in some of these years, there's some things 2, 3, 4 years apart. Everyone claims it happened this year, but it doesn't make sense if you follow the numbers exactly. But somewhere in this general vicinity, 2, 3 years around. In the year 353 BCE, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah prophesied and relayed the message to Zerubbabel and to Yehoshua that they should not be concerned about any of the previous attempts to build the Beis HaMikdash, which were halted. They shouldn't worry about the fact that they were unable to do it in the past. And on the 24th of Kislev, the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash again began. Now, this began without the permission of the royal government. It was not with the government's permission, but the prophets Haggai and Zechariah spread the word, go ahead and start rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. In response, the Samaritans and the other Gentile tribes also renewed what was their activities? To oppose it and to halt it and to stop the building. They went out of their ways to try and do whatever they could to prevent it, challenging it both physically and politically. They did everything they could to once again prevent the Beis HaMikdash from being built. Nevertheless, under the influence of Mordechai and other leading Jews, Darius, who was, according to most people, Darius was the son of Esther and Ahasuerus. So Darius, having a little bit of a connection, obviously, through Esther to his homeland, his people, Darius was said to be the son of Esther and Ahasuerus, and the other kings of the Persians were now much more favorably disposed to the Jews than were their predecessors, and therefore, not just did they allow the work on the temple to continue, but the Persian government even provided materials for the project to help make it move along and to allow it to move along. King Cyrus, who was one of the kings in that area, made the following declaration. I'm going to read it in English. Obviously, he didn't say it in English. Anyone among you from God's entire people, may his God be with him, let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and let him build the temple of God. Lord of Israel, he is the God which is in Jerusalem. And we should take that quote now. We should send it to the New York Times and let them publish it and see, you know, what they do with it. But anyway, this was said then by Cyrus. That was his comment. And in the year 371 BCE, Zerubbabel led over 40,000 people from Babylonia back to Jerusalem and brought the first wave of people to come from Chutzlaretz, from Babel, from Babylonia, back to start working on the temple, to start reestablishing the Jewish people in Yerushalayim. Ezra, however, was not amongst the first group that went. Ezra did not go back in the beginning. Ezra remained in Babylonia and Babel until after the second temple was completed. Not completely, but we'll see. On the fourth day of Kislev in the year 3410, Zechariah had prophesied that in Eretz Yisrael that there would be no need to anymore mourn the first Beis HaMikdash. This is obviously a few years before they started rebuilding. He said there's no need to mourn the old Beis HaMikdash anymore. And even in Bavel, everyone should stop mourning the Beis HaMikdash. The only way you can stop mourning the old Beis HaMikdash is if we're actively involved in creating and building a new one. You don't have to cry over stones that were pulled apart if you're busy putting them back together with God's blessing. On the third day of Adar, in the year 349 BCE, the second Beis HaMikdash was completed and dedicated. The king of Persia insisted that an engraving of the city of Shushan hang somewhere in the Beis HaMikdash, because he wanted it known who was that authorized and structured the Beis HaMikdash being built. Because I'm letting you build it, but I want the world to know who allowed this. So on the eastern gate, above the eastern arch, they took this engraving of Shushan and they hung it up. And during the period of the second Beis HaMikdash, that gate was known as the Shar Shushan. So the engraving was there, but also for our perspective, if you think about it, and we'll talk about it momentarily, every time, even when you're in the Beis HaMikdash and you look up, you have to have a reminder that you're there by the graces of the Persian government, not on your own. Takes away a little bit from the feeling of I've achieved and I've rebuilt my Beis HaMikdash. We'll talk about that soon. According to the Talmud and Sota, and other rabbinic sources, many of the miraculous and historic artifacts that took place in the first Beis HaMikdash were no longer existent in the second Beis HaMikdash. The Urim, for example, the Ark of the Covenant, was non-existent. Some of the miracles that were said to have taken place in the first Beis HaMikdash were non-existent in the second Beis HaMikdash. But because the Beis HaMikdash was indeed being put up, Jerusalem once again became the center of the Jewish universe, the center of the Jewish world. We had our Beis HaMikdash, we had our home. Ezra was a disciple of Baruch ben Neriah, who was the primary disciple of Yirmiyahu, of Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah. And the Talmud of Megillah teaches us that Ezra did not leave Babylonia, he did not leave Babel to go back up to Yerushalayim until after his teacher, his master, passed away. And it was only a year afterwards that he picked himself up. So even though Zerubbabel had already left with so many people, Ezra did not go up until afterwards. Ezra was also afraid that if all the Jewish leaders left Babel, they're going to be left with nobody over there. And he was very, very worried about that, because who's going to safeguard the Babylonian community? The Babylonian community became a very, very solid, established. Imagine all the Jews left New York tomorrow morning. New York or America even is considered a very, very strong hold of the Jewish community, and a lot of growth and all the teachings and the arts grow and all the, everything that comes out of it, all the rabbeim, all the chassid, whatever you want to say, all comes out of the America. If everything came to an end tomorrow morning because there was nobody left, you can imagine the loss and the future loss that would take place. Ezra had that same vision with what was going on in Babel, in Babylonia. The whole Talmud that we have is called the Babylonian Talmud. Ezra recognized and knew that if he would leave and leave them with no leadership, it would totally dissipate and fall apart, and he didn't want that to happen. Not just that, but while he was there, he kind of purified the Babylonian community by sifting out the lesser pedigreed elements of the community, because there was so much intermarriage, there was so much interaction from other places, he kind of like started setting up who was whom, what was your yichas, what was your from. He tried to make a little bit of a semblance of order so we can keep track. And because of Ezra, Babylonian Jewry was left whole, strong, without problems, and ultimately no questionable Jewish identities. Everybody was able to identify who came from where, proper conversions, how things were. He was able to structure that and set it up before he actually left Babel. The issue was the Babylonian Jewry, because of that, felt equal to or even superior to other Jewish communities, such as Israel, and they thought of themselves as being the ultimate place to be. They therefore sometimes overestimated their overall importance in the Jewish world. But Ezra's job was done in Babel, and he emigrated to Yerushalayim. He did what he could. He set up as much as he can, and then he picked himself up and he went to Jerusalem. When Ezra went, he brought with him 1,496 chosen men and their families. Now, this is a lot less than the 40,000 that Zerubbabel had brought a little bit earlier, all of whom were fit for leadership positions. That's the difference. Zerubbabel just brought people. Ezra brought people who can lead and can be able to take the information and go further with it. But nowhere near the amount of people that Zerubbabel brought, like I said. Ezra was the head of the Sanhedrin. And this is important. The Sanhedrin at the time was known as the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the great assembly. His court went with him to Eretz Yisrael when he traveled. They went with him to Eretz Yisrael. And we're going to see a little bit later exactly what it is that the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah established, what we owe them, and how important their role was. We're not going to expand on it too much, but we're definitely going to talk about it a little bit. Ezra also persuaded almost 38 Levite families, the Levian, to come with him to Eretz Yisrael. And he obviously needed them. Why did he need the Levites in Eretz Yisrael? Because they're the ones who are going to do the Avodah. They're the ones who are needed in the Beis HaMikdash to service the Kohanim, to work for the people, to do all the work that had to be done. And for the most part, they didn't want to go. The Levian families, the Levites, did not want to go. The vast majority of the Levite families refused to leave Babylonia. They were not enthusiastic about joining and running up to Zion and starting the Second Commonwealth. They were very comfortable where they were. This is nice. This is good. Why should I go anywhere? And that was the attitude of most of them. And he convinced 38 families, which is what he managed to take with him. Ezra therefore removed from them some of their, he punished them. The Levim who didn't want to go with them, he gave them a punishment. He gave them several punishments, so to speak. But the one big punishment that he gave them is that we all know that when a person has miser, when you have to tithe your fields and the growth of your fields, your produce, that goes to the Levi. Ezra changed that during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, that you did not have to give that to the Levi, you can give that to a Kohen instead. So therefore, the Levim, instead of being the only ones to receive this tithing, were now losing so much of their income, so to speak, because a lot of it was being given to a Kohen. If I had a friend that's a Kohen, I'd rather give it to him than to the Levi. And that was the Levim's punishment, ultimately, for being happy where they were and not making the move up to Eretz Yisrael when they were needed there so badly. Even though Ezra, when he was in Eretz Yisrael, he went back up to Eretz Yisrael now, he took charge of the social and the governmental affairs of the small Jewish community. The one thing he was not granted by the Persians at all was any policing powers. He was unable to police, and even more so, he did not have any armed forces that he can use to battle off the surrounding enemies who were still there. He did have a strong personality, as we mentioned, and he was an action, and ultimately he would get everything done. And we'll see soon that Zerubbabel came up with a lot more and was able to bring that. But Ezra himself was unable to bring any arms, any weapons to help him fight off the neighboring people around Jerusalem who were still going to attack, we'll see momentarily. Ezra realized that the return of the Jewish people to Jerusalem represented a tremendous opportunity for the eventual redemption. And that's why he was so strong. He believed that if enough people came, if enough people built the Beis HaMikdash, what do we do now? We hope the Beis HaMikdash is going to come. But if the Beis HaMikdash gets built up and all of us stay here in Brooklyn or all of us stay in Florida, then you haven't done what you have to do to be able to bring the Mashiach. Ezra recognized that so many people coming up and building a Beis HaMikdash was an opportunity for that to take place. And that's why he was so strong-willed in his ability to be able to get so many people to come up and to make change. Ezra found the Jewish social and religious life in Jerusalem totally in shambles. When he got there, it was horrendous. All the markets were open on Shabbos. Business was being done on Shabbos all over the place, which weakened the entire Shabbos spirit for everybody else. Even if it were those who did keep Shabbos, who did want to do it, when you walk through Jerusalem and all the stores are open and everything's going on, where's your desire to want to connect to the Beis HaMikdash? Here you have a Beis HaMikdash being built, and here everyone's doing business on Shabbos. It's conflicting. It's very complicated. Very difficult to be able to emotionally handle and to deal with. And also the walls of the city were still in ruins. And the Jewish inhabitants were fair game for all the hostile tribes around them and the neighborhood that surrounded them. Torah knowledge was mostly ignored. Torah learning was ignored. Time for sitting and learning was ignored. Did not exist. Not all the Jewish males even had circumcisions at that time when Ezra got up to Yerushalayim. You know, we tend to look back and think the time of the Beis HaMikdash, everything was so wonderful and glory and only, you know, super holy people. That's not the reality of what was going on at the time. The amount of intermarriage was very strong, as I mentioned before. And even to the extent of reaching some of the leaders of the Jewish observant community, even their spouses or their children's spouses had already reached the point of having intermarriage. So in spite of the new temple standing in its midst, and this is what's going up, the new temple's right there, the entire community was on the verge of assimilation. The entire community was on the verge of self-destruction. And you know what was lacking more than anything else? The one thing that was allowing this to take place was the lack of Jewish pride. You know, if you remember a couple years ago, last year, Rabbi Hammer came and he spoke at we had a session. He was a rabbi who was in the Israeli army. And he came, he spoke at Anshei Emunah, and a lot of us went out to hear him. And he was talking about how he works as a chaplain and he goes to different army bases amongst the soldiers. And he was saying one of the biggest problems is that the soldiers today don't have a pride in Israel. They don't have a pride in being Jewish to the extent that they want to die for their country. What for? They'd rather be out there with their friends doing internet games, doing learning electronics, doing all these other things that are available to them. There's a lack of pride. And just through Jewish history, he was able to attract so much of them back just through Jewish heritage and halacha or showing them what Jewish life was really about. They became interested enough to feel proud to be Jewish. And when they felt proud to be Jewish, that gave them something to get up the next day for and fight for. You're right, this is my country. Now I know the history a little bit. Now I know my heritage. I know how many people died to make this a reality. And that rejuvenated their desire to want to fight. And this is what Rabbi Hammer was explaining to us. The same thing took place back then. There was no Jewish pride amongst the people. Because, like I said, everybody was intermarrying. Everything was open. Shabbos, where's my pride? So the Jewish dependence on the Persian king was felt so badly that even if they did have, like I said, they went to the basement, I'm going. I look up, oh, there's Shushan on the wall. So we had to do something, and Ezra recognized that he had to do something to change that sense of Jewish pride and to reinstill it. And he decided that the way to do that would be through the oral Torah, and by giving them a history, and by letting them know much more about what they're about. After fasting and praying for a period of time, you know, we like to think, okay, here's what Ezra did, right? Okay, I'm just going to fix this. He woke up the next morning, and everyone started listening to him. It didn't work that way. Ezra, the Gemara says, had to sit and fast, and he had to set up days, and he had to daven, and he had to do everything that Hashem should listen to him, because he may have a game plan, he may want it to work, but it doesn't just work like, you know, just because the time has come. He recognized that if he wants to establish the Jewish front, he has to do it through a Jewish method. So he spent a lot of time davening and learning, and ultimately, on the 20th of Kislev in the year 3414, Ezra addressed a three-day assembly of all the Jews. They accepted his proclamation to be firmer in their adherence to the Torah, to their religious beliefs, to their principles, and they agreed to work on themselves to make themselves stronger and better. On the first of Teves, they set up courts to investigate and address the intermarriage problem. They sat down, they dealt with it. 3 months later, they came back with a report saying that it turned out that only 17 Kahanim and 96 others had taken non-Jewish wives. We're not talking about converts that were allowed, but there were 96 others and 17 Kahanim. That was the total number, as I'll say, of people that ultimately ended up in the circles of the Kahanim and the Jewish people. And the Talmud in Bava Kamma says that 10 major decrees that Ezra set down and instituted into the lives of the Jewish people. And Ezra also was the one who made the, this is interesting, this is really interesting. Ezra is the person who made the second ever para aduma, red heifer, in the history was Ezra who did that. The first one was made 965 years before him, and Ezra was the one who brought the second para aduma to be able to purify people from being impure, from coming in contact with death, dead people, or whatever it was, but to clear the impurity. Ezra was the only one, the second one, to ever bring a para aduma into Beis HaMikdash. The first one was brought when they left Egypt, obviously, the Exodus of Egypt. That's when the first one was, 965 years earlier. His achievement of revitalizing Jewish life in Yerushalayim in the years immediately following the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash was nothing short of miraculous. What he accomplished was, it ranks as one of the greatest achievements of a single individual in the history of Jewish history. That one individual should be able to achieve and accomplish everything that Ezra did. The Talmud tells us in Yevamos and in Kedushin as well, that Ezra was the one to give Babylonian names to the months, to the Jewish months. Originally, the months were only named like they are in the Torah. The first month, the second month, the seventh month. There's no names of the months. Ezra gave them Babylonian names, which we know as Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz. Those are not Hebrew names. Those are Babylonian names. But remember that Ezra was a scribe, and he was a scholar. And the names that he chose, those names also come from the Hebrew roots, and they have letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and therefore they have meaning in words. They weren't just names picked out. He didn't just decide to call June and July. There was meaning to that, and that's why Chazal later on is able to learn from a Torah perspective the meanings of the names of the months, because Ezra was the one who put it together. Had it been anybody who named it, then it just would have been words on a page. Ezra, having done it, made it Torah and made it a little bit more important. Now, Ezra did not do this on his own. It would have been very nice if he would have been able to get up there and be a solo individual doing this whole job totally by himself, but that's not the way it went. His companion was a very, very powerful and very wealthy nobleman, a Jewish courtier in the courts in Persia. He was intimate friend of the Persian king Darius, and his name was Nehemiah. Nehemiah was Ezra's assistant, and we'll see how he helped him out. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us there's a discussion as to who Nehemiah actually was. It's questionable if he was the famous Nehemiah. Some say that Zerubbabel, who I mentioned earlier, was the same as Nehemiah, but Zerubbabel was just an honorary name to give somebody, so they gave him the name Zerubbabel. So whether or not it was this Nehemiah, another Nehemiah, I guess the reason they have to go through that debate is because there may be places in history where we see that Nehemiah doesn't line up with the years accordingly, so you have to know which Nehemiah we're talking about. After the return to Babel, Nehemiah became a very, very important minister to Darius II. We passed the first Darius. Darius II, Zerubbabel now becomes a very important minister to him. And when he received disturbing reports on the security issues in Yerushalayim, of what was going on, he went to Darius and he asked for permission to rebuild. Remember I told you that Ezra did not have equipment, he didn't have armies, he did not have the ability to do certain things. So he went to Darius and he asked him for permission, and Darius said no. He totally cast him off, and he basically begged him, and he fought with him, and he didn't let him go. Until finally, Darius II said, okay, he granted not just the permission to go ahead and build the Beis HaMikdash, he even gave him policing power, which is something that Ezra did not have. And more importantly, he granted Nehemiah permission to bring with him weapons and people who were armed so that when he entered Yerushalayim, they should be able to fight off the people that needed to in order to rebuild the walls of the city. Because in those days, a walled city was enough to fight off. You know, if you had a wall, that was half your battle. It was accomplished. There were no airplanes flying overhead. There were no, you know, there weren't rocket launchers. So if you had a wall around your city, half of your security was established and set. But you couldn't build the wall if every time you were working on it, they would attack your people and your builders and kill them. So he actually had people building with one hand and fighting with the other, you know, in order to be able to accomplish that. Nehemiah clandestinely came into Yerushalayim. He checked out the situation. He assessed what was going on. And then he joined Ezra in planning a program that would provide physical security for the Jewish people, for the people in Jerusalem. They continued to address the spiritual deterioration and the moral climate of the people. They built the walls back up again, like I just said, and while thwarting off the attacks of the Kuthim, which are the Samaritans on the that were attacking the builders at the time. After the walls were completed, the gates went up, and the gates were fitted onto the walls, and then they celebrated with two concurring marches, dances, parades with Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, there were still a lot of uninhabited houses inside the walls, so they did not open up the gates of Yerushalayim on a regular basis. There was structured and timed when they opened, when they didn't, so they can watch and regulate who comes in and who doesn't until they fully saturated the inside with their own people and knowing what was going on. Ezra and the Anshei Knesset Gedolah excommunicated the Kuthim, who were obviously attacking them all the time, trying to prevent them from doing their thing. Now, at the time, I told you I was going to come back to the Anshei Knesset Gedolah for a little bit. The Anshei Knesset Gedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, consisted of 120 people, two-thirds of which, 80 of which, were prophets, which included Ezra, who was the head of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, Zechariah, you might recognize these names from looking at the books of the prophets, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Nehemiah, Mordechai, Zerubbabel, who I mentioned earlier, and even Shimon HaTzadik. If you read the Pirkei Avot, anytime you see Shimon HaTzadik's name is mentioned there as well. This was the rabbinic body that instituted, Anshei Knesset Gedolah did a lot. They instituted daily prayer. They instituted the Shemona Esrei in the format that we have it today and that we know it today. Blessings on everything that you have to make. The concept of making Kiddush was instituted by the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. Havdalah was instituted by the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. Regular blessings, like I said. They published social laws, instituted ritual, completed, sealed, and canonized the Tanakh, which books belong in the Tanakh, which books don't belong in the Tanakh. There were even books that are Gemara quotes that are not part of the Tanakh. The Chumash, the Navi, and the Ksuvim, these are all parts of the Torah. They determined which volumes, which stories made it, and which ones did not make it. Ezra changed the script of Hebrew. The way we know the Hebrew letters today looked different before the time of Ezra. The Ksav of Ezra, the format of the letters of Ezra, while it follows certain understandings from a Kabbalistic level, of letters and structures of letters, does not look anything the same. I wanted to bring with me. I have it home. I'm going to bring you something next time. Next week I'll show you a Ksav that I have of previous alphabet and what it looked like that does not resemble the alphabet. If you saw it in the Siddur today and you opened it up, you wouldn't be able to read five words. You wouldn't recognize what you were talking about. Ezra changed it to the Ksav, to the letters that we have today. And most importantly, he served as the main conduit for the transmission of the oral law and the tradition, because there were so many menhagim that came down from Sinai that we call Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, laws that Moshe gave. It had to come through somebody. It can only be a law that Moshe gave if it went from person to person to person. Ezra was that conduit that brought it from the previous information, the previous generations, over to the next. Had he not done that, much of that would have been lost. And he also established what the Gemara calls the Takanas Ezra, which are the ordinances of Ezra. Many of these laws were called Takanas Ezra because he was the one so involved. The Great Assembly is credited with rejuvenating Klal Yisrael, not just the knowledge of Torah. The knowledge of Torah was there. The Great Assembly rejuvenated the love of Torah. The concept that a person can learn Torah and enjoy it. that you should learn it for learning's sake. You should learn it for Torah's sake. That's something that was not there. People learned it. I got tremendous knowledge out of it. Great, I learned. But the concept of loving what you're learning, sitting down and just taking out a sefer and sitting with somebody and loving your learning, that was gone. That wasn't there. The Anshei Knesset HaGdol, the men of the Great Assembly, reinstilled that in the people and gave that back to them. The ideals and the ideas implanted in the Jewish people by the Anshei Knesset HaGdol stood the test of time. They remain a beacon of light whose decisions even today, and these ordinances even today, are the basis of all Jewish thought, and they conduct, and for them and for the later Jewish time, the later Jewish life. So they were a major, major player in establishing what we know today as our operating day-to-day Judaism. We can discuss some other time why it was they had to structure davening in the format of an 18 bracha, why they did that, why couldn't they just let every... Prior to them, if a person wanted to daven, you stood up like Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, you went outside, and you just spoke to God. But they recognized that the ability to know how to talk to God was lost. Not that they couldn't, not that you weren't allowed to, not that you weren't able to, but the ability to know what to say and what not to say was lost. And that's why they decided as a group to structure and come together. Now, while that all that was going on with the Jewish people, we need to take a look at what the attitude of the Persians were allowing this to happen, and the efforts of Ezra and Nehemiah to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. What were the Persians thinking while all this was happening and taking place? So the policy of the Persian kings, from Cyrus down through Darius, through the last of the Dariuses, was generally one of religious tolerance. They were very tolerant of other people, not just the Jews, but anybody having their own religion, and we'll see why in a second. And they embraced foreign cultures, foreign beliefs. They were very willing to let you go do your own thing. They had no problem with that. What had happened with Haman and the Purim story was unusual. That was not the normal way that the Persians would normally have dealt with somebody. They were very, very open. As a matter of fact, in the Megillah itself, it mentions the mentality of the Persians. The Megillah says, "Lios kol ish sorer beveso medaber kushon amai," that each person should be the ruler of his home and speak the language of his people. That means the Persians, that was what the Persians encouraged, that everybody should structure, they should have religion, they should speak the language of the people. They were not interested in building a melting pot empire. That's not what they wanted to, they didn't want an empire of that sort. They saw themselves as the ruler over vast universal empire that would politically and economically supervise, be in charge of everybody, and they would unite the world under their ultimate umbrella of Persia, yet allow individuals the freedom of belief and enable cultures to maintain their own social norms. You know, it kind of sounds like the workings of a democracy. This was like the pre-concept of what a democracy was really all about. In order to maintain control of each of these territories, because you have to understand, now Persia owns so much of this land, so much territory, and they're allowing everybody to have their own religion, they're allowing everybody to do their own thing. What do you do to maintain control? You don't want to lose everything. So what they did was, their chokhmah, their concept was that the Persian philosophy of tolerance forced it to place a major reliance and the trust on the priesthood in each territory, which represented the beliefs and the culture of the local people. Because if everybody's focus is going to be on their religion and on the priesthood and what's going on in the religion, then you're not going to think about so much of territorial government issues. Otherwise, they were afraid. This prevented the people from developing a desire to become Persians, to want the land. Because otherwise, what ends up happening is, if you don't think about your religion, your mind's not there, you start saying, hey, life here is good. Why don't we annex ourselves? Why don't we become separate? Why do we need Persia for? We'll do our own thing. So in order for Persia decided that in order to keep the mentality of the people away from that direction, let's keep them focused on the religion. Let's allow them to have their own priesthoods. Let them focus there. And they'll use us as the ones who support them. This one will never be in danger. It will never endanger our ruling over all these different territories in these different areas. In Egypt, the Persians strengthened the local priesthood, and it would be the exact same in Jerusalem. So therefore, because of that, Persia supported Ezra and Nehemiah, who were primarily concerned with the religious goals. They weren't concerned about taking over territory. They just wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash and teach their people what had to be taught and rebuilding the temple over the Sumerians. Because the Sumerian tribes, while they would have assimilated much more quickly into Persian culture, But they also had the possibility of, which was very dangerous to them, of becoming nationalistic and territorially, and having territorial ambitions and wanting to take over land. So if Persia had to choose between who am I going to help out and who am I going to support, the Persian kings decided that they were going to help Ezra and Nehemiah rather than help the Sumerians, who were a threat to them from that perspective. So the Persian religion itself at the time altered this very interesting concept. The Persian religion at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah was based on the doctrine of, I'm going to read it, Zoroaster, I think is the way it's pronounced, was centered around the belief of a chief national god, whose name was Ar-Mazda, who granted the Persians dominion over, quote, over this earth afar, over many peoples and tongues. The Persian belief was that the attitude supported this master race. They were the master race. That's the way Persians saw themselves. And their god was the, so to speak, master god, who graciously allowed other gods and other deities to exist. So the Persians followed the direction of their god. If my god is going to allow other gods and other deities to exist, then we, as Persians, have to allow other deities to exist. So that's the way they structured their belief structure. So while the Jews were doing their thing, the Persians were ecstatic. They were happy. They were fulfilling their own destiny as well. They were keeping themselves safe. They were keeping themselves protected. They imitated the way their god operated. Everybody was happy. All the subjugated peoples of the Persian Empire were liable to military service. Everybody had to go to the army if you want to. Taxes were on wealth, on property, and in exchange, they can take high positions in the army. They can get positions in government. You're paying the taxes, you can take the position. It wasn't a threat to Persia. They weren't afraid of that. The existence of a Jewish group of soldiers, this is fascinating. The existence of a Jewish group of soldiers in the service of the Persian king is recorded for us in a famous, it must be a group of papers, I never heard of it before, but as I was reading up on this, the Elephantine Papyrus. Arthur, I'm sure you've heard of it before. Papyri comes from the word paper, obviously, so it's the Elephantine Papyrus. This collection is a collection of messages sent by Jewish soldiers that was stationed in the upper Nile River near an area that today is called Aswan Dam, the Aswan Dam, which includes requests from the soldiers to the Kahanim in the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim to instruct them in spiritual matters, to identify, to collect calendar dates, and I know when the Yemim Tovim are, to help strengthen them in their attempts to retain their observance in Judaism. What should we do? What shouldn't we do? Shilas, they're raising Shilas of the Kahanim through the mail, through these letters. These letters have survived until our time and provide a peek through history into these ancient times to actually see letters from soldiers who were out there in the times of Persia writing to the Kahanim, how do we stay Jewish? What do we have to do to remain observant? The Persians saw their imperial role of responsibility to promote effective administration, technology, and civilization amongst the backwards peoples. The Persians constructed a great canal, which probably follows the exact same route as the Suez Canal today. They had ports from Persia directly through the Indian Ocean to Africa and the Mediterranean, and they understood that they had to take it away from their land, and they were willing to get out there and do what had to be done to spread Persian culture to the rest of the world. Even though they were still in such close proximity to the Purim story, Jews did not feel themselves endangered living under Persia because of all the reasons that I mentioned. They felt comfortable. The Persians weren't bothering them. They were allowing them to build the Beis HaMikdash. How quickly we forget that it doesn't take long for a government around us to turn. It went from Persia. They had Purim, Beis HaMikdash. Oh, we're so comfortable. We're so good. And the Jews found themselves very, very comfortable under Persian rule. The Persians seemed to guarantee them a sense of safety and comfort, and therefore they were happy there, and they didn't want to move on. They had opportunity. They had business opportunity. They had the opportunity to live, to make money, and to grow. And therefore, this was the beginning of the building of their new commonwealth. Obviously, we all know, as we get closer to the story of Hanukkah, that this once again fell apart, and the Jewish life in Yerushalayim was not allowed to continue. We will pick up on that next week, and take it from this point and go further as we enter into the times of the Greeks and into the times of the Hashmonaim coming into the Beis HaMikdash.
Very good.
Thank you.
Want any comments?